Next, I'd like to introduce Dr. Eric Warren. Dr. Warren is a special agent forensic scientist for the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation in the Firearms Identification Unit. Before joining the TBI, Dr. Warren received his PhD in biological sciences and his BS in molecular biology with minors in chemistry and Spanish from here at Vanderbilt. While enrolled at Vanderbilt, Dr. Warren was a Pinkleton Scholarship recipient and was honored as the Outstanding Graduate Student of the Year. Dr. Warren, his PhD research was focused on various aspects of DNA replication and has published several articles in this field, including an article featured on the cover of the journal Structure in 2008. Dr. Warren.
All right. As I said, I work with the TBI. I'm based here in Nashville currently. Firearms Identification Unit is the particular unit that I work in. I wake up. So obviously, my daily work is going to consist of manipulating firearms, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. Here's an aerial view of our headquarters based here in Nashville. We also have labs in Memphis and Knoxville as well, but this is our headquarters here in Nashville. So what is firearms identification? What is it that we do? Firearms identification is a branch of forensic science that basically deals with taking ammunition, fired ammunition, and matching it back to the gun from which it was fired. We have several duties in the firearms identification unit in addition to matching ammunition, which I've got listed here as number one. We also submit cartridge cases and bullets to a database that's maintained by the ATF, similar to the APHIS database for fingerprints. And this database, the presence of it, was actually very helpful in the case of the DC sniper shootings to link bullets from several different areas back to one particular firearm. Using the same theory that I'll go into for matching bullets back to firearms, we also do tool mark examinations. And this example of this would be somebody tries to pry open a door or beat open a safe or something like that. Those tools used on those objects will leave behind marks, and we can look at those. We also have bad guys that try to pull a fast one, and they think they can grind or scratch or deface a firearm that has a serial number on it, and that if they then use it in a subsequent crime, we won't be able to trace it back to them. Well, we're pretty successful in restoring those, and I'll show you a picture a little bit towards the end. Next thing that I'm going to mention is muzzle-to-garment distance determination. Basically, this is our way of figuring out how far away a person was shot from the end of the gun when it went off, and I'll go into that briefly. We also work with local agencies across the state, go out to crime scenes and assist them in especially violent crimes. We also provide expert witness testimony in court, and we serve as the armorer for the TBI, and that anybody that gets issued a weapon, it's our responsibility to maintain those weapons, keep them clean, replace any worn parts of that nature. So now that you have an idea of what we do, some requirements for the job. I'm going to skim through most of these because the state government typically uses the federal government as a pattern. We pattern our thing after them. So a lot of what Dr. Kerr said about pay scales, about it was spot on with the application. You have to write it exactly for the job listing. They look for buzzwords, and so just make sure that you get those in. So minimum is a bachelor's degree in a natural or physical science, and at least 24 semester hours of those, that curriculum has to be in chemistry. Obviously, you have to be comfortable around firearms and have the manual dexterity to operate them. And then as part of the background, as part of the application process, you'll go through an intensive background check. They'll canvas your neighborhood, talk to all your neighbors, college roommates, people you've lived with for the past five or six years ago, they'll go talk to them. It's kind of freaky. They just show up at your door one day and they want to talk to you. You also undergo a psychological evaluation and a polygraph. And as far as the pathway that I took, as an undergrad, I kind of knew that I wanted to go into forensic science. So I had applied to several places, and I figured I'd graduate the bachelor's degree, I'd meet the minimum requirements, but that's just what they are, they're minimum requirements. And so I wasn't able to secure a job, and I came to a crossroad. It was basically, do I find just a random job to pay the bills while I keep applying, or how about I go and get paid to get my doctorate? All the meanwhile, throughout my graduate career, I'm networking, talking to people, getting my name and my face out there, and then about a year and a half to a year before I was anticipating defending, you know, really started laying heavy on it, applying to as many jobs as I could through usajobs.gov and several sites I'll list at the last slide of my presentation. An advantage to that is if you do secure a job, I actually got two offers as I was getting ready to defend, and a lot of PIs like to kind of hang on to you because they've trained you and you're kind of up and running. Well, if you've got a job, kind of a way to speed, you know, you already got one foot out the door, so that was very helpful. So now, giving you an idea of how I got to where I am, I'm showing you a couple of photos here. Our laboratory that we work in looks very similar to what you would see at Vanderbilt. Our benches and our cabinetry is very similar to what you'd see. Firearms identification, though, is a very microscope-intensive field. And so each examiner has this workspace. Each examiner has their own. So I'm showing in the bottom right-hand corner one of the workspaces in general. And here is where we keep everything that we use from day to day. Some of the most basic instruments that we have for measuring, we have scales, analytical balances, calipers, that type thing. We have right here, you're not going to be able to see it, it's so small, a stereo microscope. It's for lower magnification. And it gives us kind of the depth of field view. We also have the main staple to what we use. It's right here in the center, flanked by a photo printer and a brand new Dell computer, is a comparison microscope. Basically what this microscope is, two microscopes, two fields of view that you can see combined together. So you look through one eyepiece right here at the top, and you're able to see two fields of view at the same time, and you can overlap them side by side, whatever you need to do when making comparisons. So what are we looking for when we look in the microscope? There's two different types of characteristics or type of marks that we look for on evidence that we get, whether it's bullets, cartridge cases, any other ammunition component you can think of. First thing we're doing to kind of narrow the subset of what we're looking at, narrow our options down, are class characteristics. Class characteristics are things that are designed by the manufacturer prior to the manufacturing process even taking place. And these would be things like when they're sitting down and designing the particular make of a gun, how big is the diameter of that barrel going to be? In other words, what caliber bullet will that gun accommodate? And that's a class characteristic. Another class characteristic would be something called rifling. Rifling is a spiral cut into the barrel, the inside of the barrel, also known as the bore. And what it serves to do is give the bullet a spiral as it exits the barrel, much like a football quarterback would throw a football. And that spiral, that motion, gives it accuracy in flight, gives it stability in flight, excuse me, and accuracy as it travels towards its target. So here is an example of rifling. And what we have here, lands covered in red, colored in red. This is the raised portion of the spiral, much like a barber's pole. And then the area that's been cut out, the lower area, is called the groove. And if anybody's familiar with James Bond 007, you've seen the rifling on the inside of a barrel. Okay, so the second type of characteristics or marks that we look for are much smaller. And these are called individual characteristics. We also call them mechanical fingerprints. Basically, there are tools that work on forming parts of a firearm and also finishing it. much like a kitchen knife, or even better example would be a pocket knife, the more you use that, that blade is going to get dull. That blade is going to get dings and chips out of it, such that when you cut across the surface, the marks that that blade leaves behind is constantly evolving. And similarly, with the tools that are working on guns, they're constantly changing and evolving, and thus the marks that they leave behind are changing. So that each gun, even consecutively manufactured one right after another, they'll never be the same. So they've got mechanical fingerprints that we look for to try to match. Now, you know what we are looking for, you know the type of equipment that we'd use. What does a typical day look like? Well, we're going to use an example. Let's say we're working on a homicide case, and the medical examiner is going to send us a bullet that they've extracted out of the victim. We're also going to get, in some cases, a firearm that the investigators will send in from their suspect. So they think that this particular person, this suspect, committed the crime. They want us to know. They want us to find out for them if the bullet that was pulled out of the victim was fired through the barrel of the subject's gun. However, we don't always get pristine bullets, especially if they've gone through cars or houses and ended up in a person. We also don't get pristine firearms, so a lot of times they'll come rusted, damaged, or in this case, completely disassembled. So we have a very extensive reference collection of both firearms and ammunition. The reason behind this is one of the first things that we want to do is ensure that that firearm is functioning properly, because if it doesn't work, you know, if it's rusted over, it's obviously been that way for a while, there's no way that that gun could have been used. So we're narrowing down the possibilities. In this case, it comes disassembled. Were they doing it to try to throw us off? Were they doing it to dispose of pieces? We don't know, but what we have is a reference collection. So we can go back, and I'll show you a picture of it in a second. We can go back to our reference collection, find this particular firearm, and take it apart, see how it works, to help us in putting that one back together. And if the parts are missing, we can borrow those for the time being to make the gun functional. Also, we'll get bullets in a variety of different shapes. Some are very poor. And what we like to do is shoot the exact same type of ammunition in our tests, when we test fire this gun, as we received in the case, to kind of compare apples to apples. So we have to have a large reference collection of ammunition as well. Now I'm going to show you a short video of what can happen if you find out too late that your particular tool is not functioning as intended. There's no blood and guts, I promise.
There we go.
No blood and guts. So we want to make sure that we have a functioning weapon before we proceed. So as promised, here's pictures of our reference collection. I don't think ever before seen publicly, but we have lots of them. And pretty much any shape, size, type you can imagine, we have them. And then we also have a very extensive reference collection. We have several agencies from all over the U.S. that contact us pretty regularly and ask us if we have a particular make or model of ammunition, because we do have one of the biggest collections. So we've got a functioning weapon now, and we've got the right kind of ammunition. So just like you see on CSI, we go into our range, which I think is one of the coolest parts about the job. How many people do you know can say they have a firing range in their lab? We do. So we have a water tank here that we'll shoot into, and the water basically serves to slow the bullet down without deforming it too much, so that we can have as close to a pristine bullet as possible. And there's a picture of somebody firing one. And then in the case that we don't need to recover the bullet, and I'll get to that with muzzle to garment distance determination shortly, we have a 50-yard range inside as well. So we shoot the gun into the water tank, we recover the bullet, take them to the comparison microscope, and right here you can see kind of a dividing line. So There's one microscope, there's the other combined through an optical bridge. We're seeing both at the same time. On the left-hand side, we'll put the evidence or the test bullet, whichever, and then we'll put the other one on the other side. And you can look at them together and turn them under the microscope and find the areas, if they do match, where those mechanical fingerprints line up. And in this case, you can see that they do, and you could say, well, this particular victim was indeed shot by the subject's firearm. Now, I've used some nomenclature, cartridge case, bullet, so I should probably explain that because there's actually several different surfaces of ammunition that come into contact with firearms when they are discharged. And this over here is an example of a cartridge case comparison that would function much the same way the bullet comparison I just walked you through. So one single complete round of ammunition is called a cartridge, that's shown here on the left. And the house that kind of everything lives in is called a cartridge case. It's the brass case right there. Into the base of it is inserted a primer. This is what the firing pin of the firearm hits, causes the discharge to occur. The bullet or the projectile is propelled down the barrel towards its target by the burning of powder and the expanding gases inside of the confined barrel. So cartridge case, bullet, those are the main things that we're going to look at, and also the primer, as you can see here. Now, I just wanted to show you a quick picture. I'd say about 90% of the time we're successful with these serial number restorations. Again, the bad guy will try to file it off and think that we can't catch him, and he's wrong. So this is a shotgun that a bad guy decided he would file off. There's supposed to be a make, model, caliber, and serial number all in that area. And so we have standard metallurgical techniques that we can use. Depending on the type of metal, different chemical compounds that we can apply, and this is what it looks like after. So we can actually even start to see the make, model, and caliber coming through, but definitely the serial number, which is the most important part. All right, muzzle to garment distance determination. This comes in really handy in situations where somebody's claiming self-defense. We were arguing over the weapon and it accidentally went off. Well, we can give them an idea as to whether or not that has some validity. So in that particular case, what would happen is we'd get in the actual clothing, the garments that were worn from the victim from the crime scene. And what we are looking for, when a gun is fired, the bullet's not the only thing that comes out of that barrel. There's several things. I've got some pictures here. This one's courtesy of the FBI. So right here you see the bullet. Well, also coming out of that barrel is unburned gunpowder that didn't have time to burn before it exited the barrel. And that's these darker flakes you see out here. We also have partially burned gunpowder, stuff that's burning and leaving these streaks as it's coming out. And the gunpowder that is consumed in the barrel comes out as a vaporous lead cloud. You can see a little better here. So you got all this stuff coming down. There's another good shot right as it leaves the barrel. So you got all this stuff coming out of the barrel, the firearm being deposited onto the intended target, wherever it's pointing. So all these things should be present on the victim's clothing. And what we'll do is we'll go into our indoor range using, making sure the firearm's functional, using the same type of ammo, and shooting into a similar type fabric. We'll shoot in the range at increasing lengths, increasing distances. And basically what we'll do is we'll process the garments and the test patterns microscopically for the gunpowder and also chemically for the types of combustion byproducts. And we'll look at the density and the distribution, basically the pattern of those materials, and we'll compare our tests at increasing distances to the garment and be able to give them an idea of, you know, were they shot from 1 foot away? Okay, maybe they were arguing over it. Or were they 7 or 8 feet away across the room? And so we can tell them that. I just wanted to finish with one video. It really doesn't have anything to do with muzzle to garment distance determination. But people usually like to just watch stuff get blown up. So we're going to watch some stuff get blown up. Thank you. right, and I've got some links I've posted here. These are forensic science programs that list job openings for across the U.S. And also USAjobs.gov for federal jobs. Probably not. You're not going to have time to write them all down, but I'll make sure that Kim gets these slides, so if you'll contact her, I can get you these links. So, thank you.
All right, so at this time, we'll open the floor to some questions for the speakers. Do you mind for those, flip them on? I don't know if those are already on or not. But.
I think it'd be one of two things. One, their expectation that they're immediately going to change the world. And it honestly is both a positive and a negative, in the sense that it is an energy and a vitality and an enthusiasm that you want to encourage. It's just that if the expectation isn't met, it can sometimes be disheartening to realize that the bureaucracy, that the way the government flows, that the time that it takes to actually go from policy to implementation through resources is not exactly speedy. And so it takes a while. Though I would say that is probably the largest detriment that I see. Sure. And you phrased that very, very well, because I think one of the major attributes that an effective scientist within the government brings is the ability to translate science and technology with its accuracy and fidelity to individuals who do not speak your vocabulary. And being able to impress upon them not only the importance, but while maintaining that accuracy is one of the qualities that an effective scientist, as they go through the ranks, brings. People who do not believe in science, it's usually that they often don't understand it, or that it has been presented to them in a way that they're frustrated, they don't understand the nuances. And quite frankly, when you're dealing with policymakers, particularly ones who have to think about many, many different subjects, they often rely upon their staff to make the critical decisions if there is a science evidence basis for that decision making. So I don't know that I've ever encountered anybody who doesn't believe in science. They will sometimes question specific aspects of what you're saying, and you have to go back with the references or the authorities behind it. But of all of the disciplines, I would say you actually find policymakers trust science to be nonpartisan and unbiased in most of the disciplines.
If you could please stand up and so we can project.
Sure. So two incredibly vital skills that you would need to bring are both your writing and your verbal communication. Writing, for example, on the Hill, you learn to write very quickly and very briefly. In other words, you may have a decision memo where you have studied something for months that has to be summarized in a one-pager. And so that one-pager has to say everything. And so you become very good at honing those skills of writing, often in non-technical terms, but again, maintaining the accuracy of the science. On the opposite side, in terms of verbal communication, you become incredibly good at what's called the elevator conversation. you have 2 minutes from the time that you meet your policymaker to the time that they leave you to impart the background, the recommendation, and their option for voting. And that occurs in executive branch departments, legislative branches, you name it. You hone those skills over time.
I have one question for Dr. Warren. As a recent job search person who's gotten a job, what skills of the PhD did you emphasize when applying to the PDI?
A lot of it was the critical thinking. You know, I've pitched it as I've had several of these, you know, difficult problems presented, and these are the ways we've gone about tackling them. Not getting into a lot of the, you know, technical scientific terms, you know, well, I did this particular assay or whatever. It was just we put together our heads and we were able to solve this difficult problem. That was one of the biggest things that I used to frame it.
We'll take one more question.
So I am not a political. I never have been a political, even when I was in the White House. So the staff members who serve within the Homeland Security and National Security Council do serve at the discretion of the president. And so there was a fairly dramatic turnover in between the administrations, and there usually is. In the science arena, one finds that actually that is less dramatic. And that is particularly true on the Hill, like, for example, the House Science Committee, the Senate Science Committee, don't change as often because the staff tend to be seen as more unbiased, nonpartisan in their articulation of policy matters. It definitely takes effect when or if you become a political appointee. You basically assume that at the change of the administration, you will resign. And so that's just something when you choose to accept a Schedule C or a presidential appointment that you have to keep in mind.
And everyone, join in thanking Dr. Kerr and Dr.